Hello and welcome in.
Because he shows them the magic and mystery of science in everyday living.
On Science Mixtape on Soho Radio. Morning. Yes, you are listening to Science Mixtape, and this week we are embracing the festive season, because whilst it might not be quite Christmas yet, it is certainly the time for Christmas decorations. The Oxford street lights have been on for weeks, Christmas trees are lining the streets, and Black Friday sales have sent the public into a Christmas shopping frenzy. So, who better than to help us get into the Christmas spirit than the original Soho Science presenter, Matt Allinson himself. Matt, how does it feel to be back in the studio?
It is absolutely lovely to be back here in the studio. I'm feeling Advent. I'm getting excited, walking down the streets, walking down Regent Street, all the lights are up, and I'm feeling like I'm ready to begin to get festive.
Excellent. That is exactly what we want to hear. I'm sure that our listeners have missed your bassy voice as well. For those of you who don't know Matt, he is a former chemist and now doctor in waiting.
Hopefully, very soon. Actually, I know the date. It will be February the 8th is my exam.
Yeah.
After that, I will get to be doctor.
PhD viva. And your PhD was in hybrid solar cells and printable electronics
at
Imperial College London. Wow. We'll be touching on that more later. Because coming up, we'll be talking about the future of Christmas tree lights. Some delicious facts about your Advent chocolate and how to make fake snow and some of its more surprising uses. So stay tuned for all of that. But of course, you have chosen the music today.
I have indeed, for the first time. I never used to get to pick the music when it was my show, but now,
exactly.
Now I'm a guest, I can bash you with all the terrible cheesy pop songs that I love.
Was it difficult choosing your list today?
This first song we're going with is a song that actually features on one of the Girl Talk mixtapes and has been stuck in my head on and off for about 3 years now. So I figured I'd just get it out the way to start the show off. And it's quite a chirpy song for your Saturday morning. It's Jessie's Girl by Rick Springfield. 'Cause she's watching him with those eyes, and she's loving him with that body, I just know it. And he's holding her arms late at night. You know I wish that I had Jessie's girl. I wish that I had Jessie's girl. Where can I find a woman like that, like Jessie's girl? I wish that I had Jessie's girl.
Oh, I hope you're feeling as awake as we are now. We have been dancing in the studio. Amazing. But now, we are going to move swiftly into our future of Christmas lights.
Absolutely.
And what better than your expertise in printable electronics to help us with this? Because a Christmas tree is naked without its lights, would you not say?
Absolutely. So kind of the Christmas tree light tradition, I think it's a Germanic tradition, right? Bringing in trees. I think it's like pre-Christian, a pagan thing. And they used to stick candles on their trees, which is obviously a bad idea because kind of candles and trees, kind of fire and wood, that really gets your Christmas going if like a corner of your living room's on fire. So to stop that happening, Christmas tree lights, everyone's favourite long, thin, tangled cable.
It's a tradition, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Untangling
that.
Or finding the one that has blown and set
Absolutely.
The whole circuit out.
Well, they used to be, like most light sources, used to be these things called incandescent light bulbs, which are the sort of light bulb that was invented by Thomas Swan and Thomas Edison, which is, you know, you get a coil, put an electric current through it, it gets hot, it gives out light. That's a perfectly acceptable way of making light, but it's really inefficient. So we...
loads of heat given off.
Absolutely, loads of heat given off, and also they don't last as long. So the tradition of trying to find the one fairy light that has blown... was more from a that sort of perspective when it was incandescent bulbs, because those are much more likely to blow, and if that bit of wire in the middle snaps, then there's no current can pass through, so then your whole Christmas tree lighting rig doesn't work and you've got to sort it all out. So what modern Christmas tree lights use, they use LEDs, which are called light emitting diodes, and that's a semiconductor, that's a bit of silicon, which is sort of sand but kind of like it's had some science done to it, being purified loads and being kind of pressed into this pure single crystal. And it's a very small bit of it, and as you force electrons to pass through it, so it's similar to traditional light bulbs where electricity passes through, but this uses something called band theory. This makes the electrons jump through the semiconductor in a special way, and as you make these electrons jump through your Christmas tree lights, so there's a lot of science in your Christmas tree lights. As you make your electrons jump through your Christmas tree lights, they then give out light. And these are quite cool because you can change the color of light emitting diodes by changing the chemicals that are in them.
And how far the electrons
and how far jump. That they have to jump. Absolutely. To be honest, I think with cheap Christmas lights, they don't bother doing that. They just wrap that in different coloured plastic.
Yeah, exactly. They give it like a filter.
Absolutely. But LEDs, although although they seem quite low tech, I'm looking at a lighting rig in front of me right now, and I can see hundreds, maybe not hundreds, but I can see tens and tens of LEDs in front of me right now telling me what my voice level is like and things like that. And if you have a microwave or your TV remote control, that's got LEDs in as well. So you might think LEDs are quite low tech, but 2 years ago, the man who invented the blue LED won the Nobel Prize.
Yeah, I remember talking about it.
Exactly.
Because wasn't it what revolutionized sort of our screens?
It revolutionized Blu-ray DVD players. You need a blue light source for Blu-ray. Mm. It's called Blu-ray because it uses a blue laser. And also, it really revolutionized LED house lighting, because before, you may notice that LEDs are very good at being green and red and yellow. But without blue, you can't really have like a natural light in your house from LED light sources.
Because green and blue are sort of the primary colours of light, and you need to combine them to make white.
Absolutely. So blue was needed before you could have LED light bulbs. Now, my house is now fully kitted out with LED light bulbs because I'm a little eco warrior, which I guess we'll discuss later in the science news. My light bulbs in my house, I think the most power demanding light bulb I have in my house is a 9-watt light bulb.
Wow.
Yeah.
Compared to like 60 watt or 100 watt.
Yeah, nothing like that. The most demanding light bulb in my house is my one 9-watt light bulb in the hallway. Everything else is 6 watt or 5 watt. And that's just because of LED lights, but that wasn't available until the blue one was invented. So LEDs, the stuff you get in your Christmas lights, a lot of interesting tech in there. But my PhD, I started from a solar panel perspective.
Yeah, because you were telling me the other day that solar panel science is kind of quite similar to light emitting diodes. It's almost just backwards.
Absolutely, yeah. So solar panels, the things you put on your roof or on your calculator or
harness
whatever.
The sunlight and turn it into electricity.
Absolutely.
Excellent renewable source.
Absolutely. But those, in terms of materials, are almost exactly the same as light emitting diodes. The stuff you put on your roof is also silicon. If you think about it, a light emitting diode or an LED, you put electricity in and light comes out. But the opposite principle works exactly the same. If you put light in, then electricity comes out. And that's how solar panels work. So my PhD was working on making new materials that are flexible and printable and cheap for making solar panels out of. Because the advantage of that is if you can make solar panels cheap, and especially if you can make solar panels flexible, you can use them in places like far away from any grid. So
yeah, I remember some kind of imagining a use of like a flexible solar panel might be to put it into the lining of a tent.
Absolutely.
So that at a festival, your tent is your solar panel and you can charge your phone from your tent.
Absolutely,
each
yeah.
morning.
Yeah, that would be really useful.
Incredible.
Useful stuff like that. I've seen backpacks made out of, or laptop bags made out of this flexible solar panel material, and you can charge your laptop from it as well.
Yeah, you could just have it everywhere.
Yeah, no, it's good. And the biggest kind of forecast demand for it would be areas of sub-Saharan Africa, where it's forecast that by 2025, I think it is, 90% of people will have mobile phones. I can't remember the number, but I think it was under 20% will have access to a national grid power source. Mm. So there's going to be a very large demand for, not particularly high demand, but definitely electricity demand throughout the day for people to charge their phones and other small electrical appliances. So I was working on that to some success. other people have had more success. But on the flip side of things, there are printable, flexible light-emitting diodes. Now, the people that are pouring loads of money into this are like...
Wait, are you, when you say there are printable ones, have we already got them, or it's still something being worked towards?
We do. We actually... It's easier to make printable screens than it is to make printable solar panels for a variety of reasons, but one of the reasons is that there's more money being poured into it. So flexible screens have been demonstrated by Samsung. They've made a phone that
and
you can
bend.
Is it
just on plastic?
Yes. Yeah, yeah. Wow. And the plastic can emit light, and you can make diode arrays out of it, so you can make screens. You can make literal screens you can bend. The reason they want to do that is if something is made of plastic, if you think about... in fact, we had a little accident earlier on in the studio. I knocked a clock off the wall, but it's made of plastic. So it fell from the clock fell from the table onto the floor and bounced because it's made of plastic. Like the middle of the covers come off. But if I'd done that with my glass phone, I would be panicking a lot more because phone screens are made of glass. Clocks are made of plastic. Now, if you can make a phone screen out of plastic,
it would never shatter.
It would never shatter. You can chuck your so that's the biggest problem with mobile phones at the moment.
Chuck your phone around.
Yeah, exactly. So if you think about the Nokia 3310, everyone's like, "Oh, Nokia 3310, it lasted forever." You could drive over that thing and it would work.
Yeah.
And if you remember a Nokia 3310, that thing was made almost entirely out of plastic. There was like a tiny little bit of screen that was actually recessed inside more plastic.
Yeah, the size of like a Tamagotchi screen.
Absolutely, yeah. So there's like a real drive to make mobile phone screens out of plastic because then we just won't smash our phone screens anymore.
The number one priority.
Absolutely. And how this ties all back into Christmas lights is that if you can make flexible lighting that you can print, you can... when I was doing my PhD, we used to go chat to loads of people at the Royal College of Art a lot. The Royal College of Art is next door to Imperial College London, where I did my PhD. And there were loads of people there, and I'd tell them all about printable lighting, and they would go wild. Everyone in design, and especially
textile I'm imagining stuff. Tinsel that lights up on its
tinsel,
own.
Exactly. So this is exactly what we're talking about. So we can make long, thin strips of material. You can Google it. Like, I believe Philips have started demonstrating like these cool wavy lights. So you can just get like flexible screens. I mean, you can make wallpaper that lights up.
Oh my god! Santa's grotto just got revamped.
Well, I mean, the thing that's probably going to get really crazy, if it works as well as people are thinking, is packaging labels for stuff. Because like, if you can change the price of like
if the packaging is kind of like a screen, you mean?
Yeah, exactly. If you can make packaging for like if your shampoo works out who you are and says, "Hey, you bought this shampoo before," you're just like, "Ah, go away, shampoo."
Oh, God.
There's loads of weird stuff
that's
like that.
Minority Report there's, style.
Yes, there is some Minority Report stuff that can happen with this stuff. But the cool stuff that can happen is that we can start to have Christmas decorations that we can... Because most Christmas decorations are plastic extruded molded at the moment anyway. Mm. But if we can have those that can light up by themselves, then Christmas is about to get a whole lot more garish and very exciting. Absolutely. With printable flexible lighting, I predict.
Oxford streetlights
will go crazy.
Watch this space.
Absolutely.
That was fascinating.
Wow, thank you.
Well, what song are we going to be having next, Matt?
That is it's completely off the Christmas theme now. Mostly, when I'm at work, I listen to a lot of music that isn't in English because I don't like listening to vocalless music. But if I listen to stuff that has words I understand, I get distracted. Now, this is a language that I should understand because this is a language half my family speak, but I'm very bad at languages. You will recognize the tune if you don't recognize the song name. This is called Simarik by Tarkan.
That was Turkish.
Oh my god,
I loved it.
I know. So that song, I think the story behind Holly Valance Kiss Kiss, if you, everyone listening at home who thought they recognized that from somewhere, was so that song was inescapable for one summer in Turkey. Like, that song was like every club, every night. and a load of some British producers were over there just like, God, this song this song is everywhere we go. And then they got back to the UK and were like, no, 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 no. They're like, right, we need to like re-record this with like an English singer and get this in the
so
charts.
So that
over
was
here.
Actually the original?
Yeah, that's the original version.
Oh.
So that song was like inescapable in Turkey, and all the holiday goers came back and were still humming it and like, oh, that damn song. And Holly Valance had just left Neighbours, wanted a new career. And
perfect.
So she recorded that song and recorded that rather famous video. If you can't remember the video to Kiss Kiss, look it up on YouTube.
I actually personally can't, but I do remember trying to do a routine with my little sister at
absolutely.
The time, which involved a lot of, you know, kissing our hands.
Absolutely, yeah, but over the
being
shoulder
sassy.
Absolutely, yeah, it was a ridiculous. It was a ridiculous time to be Turkish growing up in England and being like, why is this song everywhere? so that's one of the many languages that I should be able to speak but can't.
Excellent choice there.
Thank you.
Moving swiftly on. We have now got to the stage where we're going to be doing our experiment. And this week, yes, we are making some fake snow.
We are indeed.
With the help of Michael Bublé. Oh, so,
he's here?
Yeah. In his spirit.
Yeah.
Now, all you need for this is a cup, some fake snow powder,
mm-hmm.
and some water. You will be taking five millilitres of your fake snow powder and mixing it with 60 milliliters of water, so you may want a measuring glass as well. Right, let's get going. Okay, I'm donating my hands and Matt is going to guide us through it.
Excellent. Right, so this powder is rather exciting material called sodium polyacrylate. This is a weird powder. This is a weird material. It's a polymer, but it also has sodium ions hooked into it. And it can contain up to 300 times its own mass in liquid, which means that when you pour water on it, it really like bubbles up loads. So here we go. And what should happen, so as you pour water on it, it expands and grows, and it grows into this white, big, fluffy, rather exciting snow, basically.
It feels really strange, actually, because it's slightly warm. I'm guessing the reaction's a bit exothermic.
It will be exothermic, yes.
And then it kind of puffs up in your hands, like from nowhere.
So this material is incredibly useful. So this you use it in making fake snow for snowboarding hills and stuff like that as an additive to the water. It's the fact it's super absorbent means it's really useful for loads of things. You can use it. You can use it in your washing up. Some washing up powders use it to help remove hard water impurities. And its most famous usage, and my personal favourite usage, is the fact that it's what NASA use in the nappies that they put on astronauts. Because if you're out doing a large spacewalk and you need to go, it's difficult to go in space.
Astronauts wear nappies. How is this not a more widely known fact?
So you know how in the lunar landings...
Yes.
So Buzz Aldrin, Neil Armstrong, all that lot. They went to the moon and they walked around on the moon and they spent 2 days on the moon.
Mm-hmm.
When you're designing a spaceship, they didn't really design a toilet facility for it. The entire time they were wearing nappies but when you leave the moon, you need to leave as much unnecessary stuff behind as possible, so you have as little weight as possible, so you can
less
be fuel efficient.
Less fuel is needed, yeah.
Absolutely. So they left a lot of equipment behind. They left all their cameras behind. They took the film out, but left all the cameras behind. There's loads of really expensive science equipment left on the surface of the moon. And there is also...
Quick, if anyone can make a rocket.
Absolutely, you can go get some really nice cameras. There is one that was bought back because it didn't work properly, and they bought it back to try and work out why, and that's one of the most expensive cameras in existence. Anyway, but this is where I was going. Rather grossly,
they leave their nappies behind.
They left their nappies on the surface of the moon. There's this article that says there's about six missions worth of two men's nappies. And also, NASA are a bit sketchy about it as well, but it's also says sick bags.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So, like, if you go to the moon, like, be careful where you put your foot. It's a bit like a music festival. You know, there's, like, debris everywhere, and some of it you really don't want to open.
No, you really don't.
Yeah. But, yeah, so they...
On the plus side, if you're feeling a bit queasy at your Christmas party, just find some fake snow.
Just find some fake snow. That
It'll
stuff is
absorb
really,
it all up for
absolutely,
you.
Absolutely, yeah. So this stuff called sodium polyacrylate, you can get it. It's really easy to buy on Amazon, right? Or any other commercial retailer.
That's where I got mine from.
Yeah. And it absorbs water and retains the water as well. So if you want to have like a snowy, if you're making an over the top Christmas display in your front garden, you can just use the stuff and leave it out and then just spray water on it occasionally to keep it going.
Yeah, because if you don't spray water on it, it actually dries up and it dries back into its powder, so it's reusable. Top tip, if you're trying to get rid of it, do not wash it down the drain. You will block your drains.
Because it will destroy your drain, yes.
You want to hoover or sweep. All the fun with fake snow. What is our next song going to be?
Our next song is... this is another song that I get stuck in my head a lot, but as I do not know the words or even how to pronounce any of the words... it's very annoying because I just tunelessly hum it. It's called Vaua by a Finnish pop singer called Kazmir, and it's I think Vaua translates to babies. I think it's sort of a duet, and I think he is like telling a lovely lady that he wants to have babies with her. But it's really funny. The video to this song is also very, very amusing.
We will be tweeting if you want to see it at Soho Radio, and stay tuned because after this song we'll be talking about
advent
calendars. Yes. Niko hiljaa vaan, mä sulan kun sä katot mua, mä koitan olla viileä. Damn mama, mä ihanen sun geniä, kyllä sä tiedät sen. Probably everyone's favourite thing about the Advent season is Advent calendars. Have you got one yet, Matt?
I have not got my Advent calendar yet. Me and my girlfriend are thinking of... You can get like those really cringe couples ones from Thornton's.
Really?
I'm really thinking of getting one of those.
is it like a his and
hers
chocolate?
Tell me more about these cringe couples.
So cringe couple Advent chocolates have... I think they have two in one door. So you open it and there's like...
One each.
Yeah. Oh. And I think maybe I don't because those Thornton's, you can get Thornton's ones that like have names put on like the 24th one. So I think maybe you can get like a cringe message like that as well. And also the best, we're not spending Christmas together this year, so the best thing would be like the day before we go back to our respective families, we just get a binge on loads of chocolate together as well. So that's that's like the real Christmassy spirit.
Definitely indulgence all the way.
Absolutely.
My flatmates have already started the Christmas grotto, which apparently is a thing that they do every year.
Well, now you've got some fake snow to give them too.
Exactly, I know. So we've got a tree, and they also bought all of us Mars advent calendars.
Oh, yeah. Very nice.
Spacey and chocolatey.
Excellent. Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. On point. How about you, Anna?
I had an advent. I haven't got mine yet, but last year I had one from Frozen. I was in this queue, and there were just like all these 10-year-old girls and me with my Frozen advent calendar.
That's amazing. Well, we've actually celebrated Advent since the 4th century as the start of the new Christian year, when new converts to Christianity prepared for their baptism. And then it got kind of taken over as waiting for the arrival of Jesus. But it wasn't originally for his birth. Advent calendars, however, started much later in the 19th century, again by the Germans. They just seem to be kings of Christmas.
They are on it.
They love Christmas, those guys.
And they didn't have like printed calendars with nice pictures. They started off just with like marking chalk on, like they draw out some doors on the wall and just chalk mark them.
Okay.
Or they'd light a candle a day and stuff.
Right.
So our first printed ones were by a guy called Gerhard Lang in the 1900s, and they actually were stopped during the World War because cardboard had to be rationed.
Oh no.
I know. And we've had chocolate ones since 1958.
Oh, that's exciting. I didn't realise they were so recent.
I think this is the commercial sector taking off,
I guess.
So the chocolate part is where the interesting science that we're going to get into comes from. I mean, there's just some nice terminology I like. So obviously you've got the cocoa tree, which is where we get all the kind of natural raw ingredients that give us our lovely chocolatey flavour. And its technical name is Theobroma cocoa. It's a member of the evergreen family. And Theobroma literally means food of the gods.
Oh.
So even back in the day, it was considered beautiful. But the word chocolate comes from a now I can't even pronounce this, Nahuatl word, Zoclatl, which means bitter water, because it's only quite recently that we've made it sweet.
I see, okay, yep, with the additions of sugars and
yeah,
all that
sugars
stuff.
And kind of milk and stuff, yep. Yeah. So to make amazing chocolate, you want chocolate that's going to melt in your mouth. That is the sort of great sensation that everybody loves, and that's when all the flavours are being released onto your tongue as it's melting. Mm-hmm. So, but the best chocolate is made with a melting point of 34 to 36 degrees. Now, you've got your cocoa butter in chocolate, and that is made up of three different kinds of fatty acid molecules. So you've got three different fats in your cocoa butter. And the important one is called oleic acid. And so a fatty acid, I don't know if you're aware, Matt, is made of a glycerol head mm-hmm. with three fatty acid chains.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of, in my head, I like to picture like a jellyfish with three tentacles.
Yeah.
And in oleic acid, one of the chains is kinked. So like if you were sticking your leg out to the side.
Right, okay.
And this means that if you were packing loads of these fatty acid molecules together in a structure like chocolate, the ones with a kink have a bit more space between them because they're...
It's kicking out.
It's kicking out. It's pushing the others away. So it takes less energy for them to move between each other.
So that means it takes less energy for them to melt.
Absolutely. So the more of those you have, the lower your melting point.
Right, okay, yeah.
What I didn't realise was cocoa butter can form six different crystal structures.
But very interesting.
Only structure five is the one that we want, which has a melting point of about 34 degrees. It'll be glossy, firm, and snap nicely. So that is what you want. Too much, and you'll get ones that melt at like 17 degrees, mm-hmm. that is the polymorph one, or up in the 40s when it's like really hard and it takes a really long time to form and to make.
So is this why when you're watching Bake Off, they're all really careful about the temperatures at which they're using when they're making their chocolate icing? Because you need to have really fine temperature control with your chocolate, because if it's got all those different crystal structures.
Yeah.
That sounds interesting to me, because that's in a very bizarre way. I originally did my first degree was in materials engineering, which is basically steel and like heavy metal work. but you have to do similar sorts of things with metal as well. You need to make sure that you cool it at the right rate and you keep it at the right temperature, because otherwise it forms a crystal structure you don't want, and it will melt at the wrong temperature. Or if you make a boat that's supposed to sail in cold water, but you make it of the wrong crystal, then your boat will just sink because it will like, break apart in the cold water.
My God.
But it's odd that chocolate is sort of the same. Like if you want to make a chocolate that melts in your mouth, you need the sort of same sort of like principles behind it.
Yeah, and that's why you've got sort of really expertise chocolatiers, and the chocolate will go through something called tempering, which is a continuous process where it's kind of cooled and then sort of warmed a little bit and cooled again. And as it does that, it will form different types of these crystals. Mm. And by sort of tempering it around the optimum melting point that you want, you can kind of get rid of the bits that are melting too quickly.
That's literally a process you use in high temperature metalwork as well.
It's
crazy that the same principle applies. I didn't realize that. That's a tempering and kind of work hardening and holding stuff at the melting point so all other crystals precipitate out or can be skimmed off the top is what you do when you make steel.
I didn't know that either.
I knew it about steel. I didn't know you did it with chocolate. That's so cool.
steel science behind your chocolate advent calendars.
Absolutely. Oh, that's really... Oh, that's fun.
There you go, listeners. We have all learned something new today. All round. I think it's time to celebrate with another song.
I think it is as well.
What have you got next?
Right, so this is... So Turkish is a language I should speak because that's the language my family speak. Finnish is a language that I would like to learn because that's the language my girlfriend speaks. But because I listen to loads of foreign language stuff on Spotify now just recommends me stuff that isn't in English, which is nice.
Great.
So this is a language I have no particular tie to. This is in Swedish.
Ooh.
Which you might think is
kings
related
of
to
pop
Finnish
music.
The absolute kings of pop music. Mm. They frequently sing in English, but this is actually in Swedish, I think. This is an artist called Little Jinder, and the song is called Sommarnatt.
Absolutely, science news. And this week, the biggest story was probably the 100th anniversary of Einstein's theory of relativity. Would you not agree?
Yes, that is the kind of the birth of the kind of 20th
just
century
so
understanding.
Yeah, I was gonna say, the birth of the 20th,
the birth of the 20th century kind of understanding of all of science really kind of came from a series of lectures that were given to the Prussian Academy of Sciences by a fairly well-known man with some crazy-looking hair called Einstein, and his final it was a series of lectures that he gave that finished on the 25th of November 1915. And so general relativity, for obviously those who don't know, is the sort of, for 100 years, well, for 200 years, everyone sort of assumed that everything worked like Isaac Newton had said, which, if you're on Earth, is like not a bad thought to have, because Newton's theories explain exactly how gravity works on Earth. But then when people started looking at things off Earth, it started to not make sense, because so Mercury, which is the planet that orbits closest to the Sun, its orbits didn't behave the same way that Newton said they would. And a few other things were beginning to look like perhaps that gravity wasn't quite sorted. And about 10 years previously, Einstein had come up with this really clever thing called special relativity, which explained the way light worked properly and how light and electromagnetism all kind of tied together, because that had been a big question no one had understood. And when he came up with that theory, everyone was like, oh, so that's a really cool theory you've come up with there, Einstein, but how does gravity tie into this? And he was like, oh, goodness. Give me some time to work this out. And he did. He worked it out, and it's this theory called the general theory of relativity. And what this sort of says is that space and time are the same thing.
Yeah, you got the space-time continuum.
You got the space-time continuum. And that mass bends the space-time continuum, and all effects of gravity are actually just things moving through this warped space-time.
Yeah. Because if you imagine something trying to travel in a straight line, like along some material, and then the material was bending towards a big ball in the middle, then the thing would still be traveling a straight line, but it would be traveling in a straight curved line, if that kind of makes sense, along the curve.
And absolutely.
That is what grounds us to our planet.
That is what grounds us to our planet. So that's why, that's what grounds us to our planet. That's what was causing Mercury's orbit. What I said, people said it didn't really make sense. That was what's causing Mercury's orbit to be a bit weird. When Einstein came up with this, he said he predicted that if there was a total eclipse of the Sun, you'd be able to see light from behind the Sun being bent round the Sun.
And
a few years after, very shortly after the prediction, it was there was a total eclipse of the Sun, and they measured that, and that was the first proof of the general theory of relativity. He also said there'd be these things called gravitational waves, which we still haven't quite been able to see. We thought we saw them at the beginning of the year, the beginning of last year, but it turned out we hadn't.
But they've got some giant detector.
This giant monster called LIGO, which has been running for about 15 years, which is a really interesting experiment. I could talk about LIGO at length. I'll talk about briefly what you do. So gravitational waves are another. So if space-time is a thing that bends when mass moves it, if you have a lot of mass moving very fast, then you would make waves. As in, if you've got water and you hit it, then waves travel through it. So when we're talking about lots of mass, we're talking about galaxies colliding with each other. We're talking ginormous quantities of mass. But ginormous quantities of mass do exist elsewhere in the universe. So gravitational waves bend space-time perpendicular to each other. So if you have something at 90 degrees, so like the letter L, if a gravitational wave passes through it, one bit of the L, one bit of the L will get shorter and the other bit of the L will stay the same, and then your L would kind of jiggle backwards and forwards with one leg getting longer and the other getting shorter. So what these experiments that are looking for gravitational waves do is they fire a laser beam down a big letter L. It's a letter L that's the size, it's about 3 kilometres each leg of
it. It's a giant experiment.
Huge. and then they bounce them off mirrors and then they come back. And what they look for is they look for the laser beam being different when it arrives back at the source. So the laser beam itself is also a wave. And what they're looking for is one bit of the laser coming back out of sync with the other, because that would mean it's travelled a different distance.
Yeah, so if the distance had changed, then it would.
Absolutely. The problem they have with these detectors is that so there's one in Louisiana and one in Alaska, and They are so sensitive. I read an interview once where the guy said in Louisiana, he said, the problem we're having at the moment is if a guy slams the door in Alaska, we pick it up here.
That's just incredible, exactly, isn't it? It's amazing.
It's so sensitive, like they're getting so much noise. So this experiment's been running for a very long time, but the what they're actually trying to do is actually just get the noise out of the signal and see if they're detecting gravitational waves. But that'd be really cool if they do, because that's the final, it's called like the final bit of general relativity we haven't proven yet. Mm. And everyone's really obsessed with proving general relativity because it doesn't actually explain everything about the universe. It doesn't, it predicts a lot of things.
Dark matter and dark energy though, doesn't it? So if we felt pretty confident with that as our sort of model of how things work, then we can feel pretty confident that dark matter and dark energy exist as well.
Absolutely. But there are holes in our understanding that are left by general relativity. And what people like to do in science is they like to look for, if you test all the theories you know and you trust to breaking point, then when the theory you know breaks, then you know how to do, then you can start doing new science. Mm. So people test every little bit of general relativity, all the bits we don't know, to see if they break at any point.
And if then, so, that's like, and then the that's path our to new, follow.
Absolutely. So who knows? So yeah, so it's the birthday, it's the 100th birthday of general relativity, or the 100th birthday of general relativity was this week.
Crazy is apparently he came up with this theory at 26 years old.
So the interesting thing about Einstein was, I'm speaking very broadly here, after general relativity, he spent the rest of his career more or less being wrong. It's very favorite. He was
trying to come up with his universal equation of
absolutely
his theory of everything.
Einstein, yeah, he came up with three theories that are right and are so right and like the most right anyone has ever been. He was like, it's exceedingly clever, like so correct, and it was incredible that he did it all himself, and it was incredible that he had to do it like being outcast a lot from the academic scene because of anti-Semitic rules in Austrian and Swiss and German universities. But then the rest of his career, once he made his name with relativity and the photoelectric effect, he hated everything that came after and spent loads of his time like trying to prove that it was wrong, which was sad for him because it was right. but you know, it was not to kind of like cast aspersion on the rest of his career, because it was useful that Einstein was wrong, because Einstein came up with all the wrong ideas, so no one else had to waste time doing them. So he did still continue the scientific process, but it's very famous. Everyone's like, Einstein, the most clever man on earth. But like, he did spend from
his
basically
greatness
the age of 30 26. Onwards. Yeah, he was very much wrong for most of it, and was kind of semi-responsible for the nuclear bomb. But you know, whatever. lots of people were responsible for the nuclear bomb, so I guess it's not, we can't just pin it on him. But it's
puts your life in perspective, though. Like, I'm 26. I have not come up with any theories of the universe.
I've not come up with anything. Yeah, no, it's really miserable, especially when you William Lawrence Bragg is another scientist who won the Nobel Prize for his master's thesis. you just say, I'm not winning anything for my master's thesis.
Hey, you're going to bring Christmas lights into the future.
I could bring a futuristic
and
Christmas lights.
Chargeable tents at festivals. I mean, that is solving a problem.
Winning in my books, man.
Smash proof iPads. I mean, I'm just going to throw this out there. There are thousands of people around the world working on printable electronics. It's not all just me. and some of them are actually good at it as well. So, but yeah, so that's science news this week. We've got Einstein's general relativity's birthday.
Absolutely.
What else did you spot?
So we have, they've been declaring this year as the warmest on record. And this is quite relevant because this weekend we've got Paris talks.
Yeah, yeah.
You know much more about this than I do, Amna, so I'm going to let you take over.
Yeah, so the world leaders are coming together in Paris to try to come up with a new international treaty to tackle climate change. From the analysis that I've been reading, people seem quite hopeful. So we see some of the pledges that people have put in to say we will try to make our emissions not go past a certain amount have been better than expected. There are a lot of people who are saying if we, you know, we need to be doing more or we will pass this 2-degree limit. I think also it's worth noting that at the end of this year, it's likely we'll pass the 1-degree limit. So we are halfway to oblivion.
So 2 degrees is the 2 degrees is the point where you know the rivers of blood start flowing, yes, the locusts, yes, the hand of God reaches down.
Well, no, something like that.
I heard that we already are past the 1 degree limit.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Maybe. So, well, the Met Office said that they think we're likely to be passing the 1 degree limit by the end of 2015.
If you take into account 2015, then we have gone past the 1 degree limit, because there was a point for a couple of years everyone thought, oh, global warming is fine, because it kind of stalled and it looked like we weren't heating up as much. But this is all to do with the phenomenon of El Nino. So my brother, who's a weather forecaster, was explaining this to me. And basically, you've got these great sort of ocean currents, which when they're in what you call La Niña, the sort of normal cool phase, you've got these winds blowing the sea off South America and pushing the water back, allowing a cold current to come up from the depths. And when that cold current is up at the surface, it obviously gets heated up by the atmosphere and it cycles round, and that warmer water then sinks back down. So it was
that cools the earth. It's like
a... Yeah, it's acting as a heat sink, essentially. Right. And that was what was absorbing a lot of our atmospheric heat and meant it looked like we weren't heating up as much as we were. Mm. But when you have these winds at less than average speeds, so they're just not blowing as strongly, that water's not pushed back as much, and there's nowhere for the cold water to come up, so the whole cycle is broken down. Mm-hmm. And this warm phase where the cycle's not really happening is called El Nino. Mm. And we are in an El Nino phase at the moment. It's going to peak at the end of the year, according to him. And that is why we've suddenly seen that we've jumped back up and it's going to be the hottest year on record. Mm. Some of the things it predicts have already happened, like less than average rainfall in the Indian monsoon. And what European listeners might be interested to know is that it also predicts that we'll be having a much colder tail end to our winter. So kind of February, Marchy time will be colder than normal, but we've had a much warmer into the winter, which I think, right, we can all agree our November has been incredibly mild.
Absolutely.
Not complaining, but also if it's...
We might be in March when it's still snowing.
Yeah, exactly. No, but climate change is still such a huge issue, and there is going to be a march tomorrow for any Londoners who want to get involved.
I think maybe more than London, though. Is it they frequently run these across several cities at once?
Yeah,
right?
It's okay. Worldwide.
Any UK?
Oh, worldwide.
Worldwide. Any listeners at all?
So different cities, international cities, are getting involved. It's really interesting because when I report on climate change now, there's no like skeptics. People know it's happening, but what the skeptics are now doing is like, being the world getting warmer can be actually a good thing. So everyone's discussing this like Goldilocks temperature, and what you can actually see from climate change is it's a bit like a reverse Robin Hood. Like if you live in like a really, really cold country, the Nordic countries are likely to benefit quite significantly from climate change, whereas a lot of the world's poorest, like in Africa and the Middle East, it's just going, they're like set to lose out on a lot from like agriculture and stuff.
Yeah, desertification.
So it's gonna be interesting.
Well, there's it's a giant can of worms, but there's the climate change caused the Syrian crisis argument going around at the moment, which if you're...
The Egyptian uprisings as well.
We could probably do an entire hour on that, but maybe look that up at home, but it's on the basis that farming has been so heavily damaged in the Middle East that it has resulted in the unrest that we're seeing played out at the moment.
Yeah, because if all your crops are dying and people are sort of struggling to get food, it leads to feelings of we need a change.
Absolutely. Mm. But yes, so climate march tomorrow. It starts at 11, doesn't it? Oh, well, I'll be there from 11. So if you just see a man who's either missed it or is very early, just come say hi.
Are you taking any signage with you?
I might take some signage. I'll see what I've got at home.
Yeah. But yeah. Unfortunately, I won't be there, but I'll be marching in spirit from Suffolk. Well, any other final news stories that you wanted to mention?
So I work in academic publishing, which is really good fun because it means I get to read about loads of interesting science but never have to do it. I work in a journal called Royal Society Open Science, and we published a really fun paper this week because at the moment there's the Giraffidae family, which is sort of like, you know how kind of like cats and lions are the same species, but you can also see there's like animals like cheetahs and then like lynx and panthers. So there's lots of creatures that look like they might all be related to each other in the same species called feline. In Giraffidae, there are two... things that are alive, something called an okapi, which looks like a gazelle, and something called a giraffe, which looks like a giraffe.
Mm-hmm.
And so if it looks like it, so there's two things together, and they've got hugely different necks, and everyone's like, how are those things cousins? They literally look nothing like each other. But what some paleontologists have found is a giraffe with like a medium-sized neck.
Oh my god.
Exactly, that lived 7 million years ago, and everyone's like, oh thank goodness, we've solved how these things are related. It's sort of
like the missing link that we're always trying to find between ourselves and monkeys. They found between
the giraffe and gazelle. Yeah, there's just the bizarre thing that sort of has a medium shaped neck, which obviously didn't quite make it through the evolutionary kind of blender. We've solved a mystery that's been plaguing people who think a lot about giraffes. They can sleep soundly at night. So that's good.
Excellent news. A festive present for those giraffe lovers.
Absolutely.
Well, it's now time to be the end of the show, but I could chat to you all day, Matt. It's been so lovely having you back.
It's been an absolute pleasure to come back. It's looking very pretty this year, and the studio is all set up for Tony Moore's show coming up next, so stick around. It sounds like it's going to be exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. Busy show, as always.
Yeah.
Not one to miss. We're going to play out with your final song.
Absolutely. This is Sufjan Stevens off his first Christmas compilation. So I start listening to the Sufjan Stevens Christmas compilation in about mid-September, but then I worry that I'm going to peak, so I stop listening. But now it's like late November, I'm straight back on it. This, to play me out, is Hey Guys, It's Christmas Time.
We travel in a one-horse open sleigh. Now that it's Christmas,